from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, many of us spend more time in traffic than we do eating meals with our family, going on vacation, or having sex. And we spend more money on driving than we do on healthcare or food. And all of this shouldn't come too much of a surprise, seeing as the last census revealed that there are more cars than there are citizens. In the hour ahead, we'll talk about traffic and driving, including the psychology behind driving and facts that will both interest and surprise you. Tom Vanderbilt, the author of Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do and What It Says About Us, will join us in studio with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's second hour of the Forum program. Traffic has become a way of life, so Tom Vanderbilt states in his book Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do and What It Says About Us. A few statistics are in order here that are right out of Tom Vanderbilt's book. In 2005, Americans spent an average of 38 hours annually stuck in traffic. And the World Health Organization predicts that by the year 2020, road fatalities will be the third leading cause of death. Obviously, driving and navigating through the roads and highways, as well as the 1,500 to 2,000 discrete skills that are exercised while driving, matter a great deal. And driving plays a preeminent role in our lives, even for those of us who don't drive. And in this Forum Hour, we're going to talk with Tom Vanderbilt, who's contributing editor of two design magazines and contributing writer for a blog called Design Observer and author of the national bestseller Traffic. And he joins us by ISDN line from New York City. And welcome, Tom Vanderbilt.
Great to be here, Michael. Thanks.
Good to have you. Well, first we should begin by, well, a premise that comes across in your book. Most of us, maybe even all of us, think that we're good drivers.
Not just good, but indeed sort of better than average. And this is a funny thing that comes up if you ask a large group of people in surveys, as researchers have done, and you get a majority of people responding that they are an above average driver, which, you know, it doesn't take a mathematical genius to realize that something might be a little bit amiss there. And you even see that effect when you have groups of expert police drivers. Even within that group of supposedly above average drivers, you find what they call the above average bias. So just something about humans, we like to, I guess, self-enhance.
Well, or maybe I remember my dad telling me as a boy, when you learn how to drive, think about every other driver as being a lunatic. Maybe there's something of that involved, that you think everybody out there is not necessarily as trustworthy or as confident behind the wheel as you like to think you are. But there are a lot of things that we learn from your book that are really counterintuitive. You know, with all these new technological gizmos, navigation systems and the like that assist us, they can actually be more of a problem, you point out, in emergencies. And in many respects, by making roads safer, we're actually increasing accidents, things that normally don't occur to us.
Well, I mean, one example I like to bring up is roundabouts, for example. This is something that the U.S. actually invented the roundabout back in the early 19th century, but it since went over to Europe and sort of became associated as a European idea. But that was really the old traffic circle. Now we're talking about the modern roundabout. It's coming back to the U.S., and towns across America are bringing it in because it seems to be a safer way to handle certain types of traffic situations, and it actually helps traffic flow better. But if you ask the average person out on the street, they find roundabouts to be sort of a frightening environment, and thus they think they are more dangerous than a traditional intersection with either stop signs or traffic lights. But for a couple of reasons, roundabouts actually turn out to be safer. Just number one, the way they're designed. But number two, that I think that very sense that a person feels a little bit of fear going through this environment, not so much fear, but a sense that you have to really know what's going on. You have to sort of pay attention. This helps increase sense of vigilance, and thus helps contribute to safety. But again, if you ask the average person, roundabouts, bad. Traffic engineers are evil for bringing these into the U.S., but we've got about 2,000 of them now. And you know, to come to the level that Australia has, for example, we'd need about 200,000.
Backseat drivers actually make us safer too, we learn from your book.
Well, just passengers in general, and this is a funny thing. You know, of course, none of us like to get that information from other passengers, the backseat driver. But a study showed that people with passengers in the car turn out to be less involved in crashes than solo drivers. The exception here, of course, are teens, and teens actually behave worse when they have passengers in the car. And the more passengers they have, the worse they behave. But this points to something that I think we often miss in driving, and it's something we don't even think about much, is that sense of feedback that is often missing from our daily drive. We sort of go out, we come back home. No one is out there telling you how you did on the road, unless, of course, you were pulled over for a violation by a police officer. But absent something like a passenger, or another way to think of it would be a co-pilot, you know, we often are blind to the mistakes that we might be making. And it's very easy for us to see the mistakes that other people are making and castigate them for being an inferior driver, as you mentioned. But again, we don't often get that feedback directed back at us. And this, I think, is one of the reasons why a passenger does help, along with providing an extra set of eyes, of course.
And we're talking to Tom Vanderbilt, who's the author of Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do and What It Says About Us. Well, we've got this Cash for Clunkers program. Also learned from the research that new cars are more apt to crash than old cars.
Yeah, that was a study done in Norway, and you get into a couple of things there. The question is, are new cars driven more than older cars? Yes. I mean, a lot of those cash for clunkers, these were things sitting around people's yards that they really weren't driving much of anyway, so we could argue whether it was a good thing or not. But people do tend to drive new cars more, so there would be a higher chance that they would get into a crash. There'd be more exposure. But another issue there is that if you have sort of a new 2009 BMW with all the latest safety technology on board, many airbags, compare that to sort of a 78 Yugo or something, a rust bucket with no airbags, barely a seatbelt. It doesn't take a genius to think that you might adjust your behavior a little bit. You might feel more confident in that newer car, thus drive in a manner that might lead you to take more risks and thus get into further crashes.
Well, speaking about adjusting behavior and taking risks, you begin by asking a question in your book, why does the other lane always seem to be moving faster? And you had this epiphany on the New Jersey freeway, which caused your wife to cringe and cover her face. But it became sort of a metaphor for you in many ways, didn't it?
It did. And just to describe that briefly, it was a situation where I think we've all had this, where you're sort of driving along and suddenly two lanes are going to become one, or three become two, because of a construction situation. And there was a long queue of vehicles in the lane that was going to remain open. And there was a nice stretch of empty asphalt in that lane that was going to be closed. And I lined up early because I was an early merger. I thought it was the polite thing to do. But I grew frustrated because cars kept passing me in that open lane. And I wondered, why am I sitting here wasting all this time? It just seems there's empty real estate there to be had. So I jumped and became sort of a late merger. And again, my wife was sinking in the seat. She could feel the hostile look of other people. But so I started posing this question to people out there that I knew, and I was getting kind of a split on the responses. The majority said that what I had done was wrong, that I was a cheat. I was making the system worse. I was making slowing things down for everyone. And a few people said, no, you were being rational. There was empty highway space. Why should people form an early one-lane queue? And so I started looking into traffic engineering research, which kind of uncovered this vast, fascinating world of the people who study problems like this on the road, how to get two lanes to merge into one, which is a lot more complex than I ever imagined. And the short answer is that what I thought was previously the wrong thing to do arguably is the right thing to do. If we could get all those cars to simply go all the way to the merge point and then do a one-on-one merge, at least some studies found more cars actually got through that bottleneck point.
Well, you can instill a lot of aggression in fellow motorists when you do that sort of thing. And in fact, one of the things I found myself musing about in reading your book, which is now available in paperback, we should add, it was the fact that there's a good deal of rage and aggression that simply seems to follow many of those who are behind the wheel.
Yeah, I think in that case, often, it comes down to a situation where we have conflicted expectations of what the right behavior is. And often it comes down to it that the reason for that conflicted sense of feeling is that we actually don't have a firm grasp of the actual traffic laws. And I see this a lot. I've seen this a lot this past summer with a lot of very sort of high-profile confrontations between drivers of cars and cyclists on the road. And it often comes down to drivers sort of saying things that, you're a guest on the road. You don't belong there. You're a hazard. And, And that my favorite is that cyclists are violating traffic laws. And, I don't think the drivers of America, given my experience on the highway, I mean, go to your average highway right now. How many people are obeying the speed limit? So for the drivers of America to have the moral authority to question other people's law-abiding nature, I think they don't have that authority.
There's a good deal of enmity between drivers of automobiles and drivers of bicycles. Not always, but certainly it's out there. It's ubiquitous. Also, pedestrians and motorists and truck drivers and car drivers. I mean, we see these sort of splits, all of which you touch upon and allude to in your book. And it just highlights the fact that when somebody's alone in a car, as most people are, despite all the attempt to get carpooling and all of that for environmental purposes, there is something that takes them over. There is a kind of different psychology.
Yeah, my favorite phrase that was given to me on this was someone called it modal bias. And the idea is that whatever mode of transportation you're in, that mode sort of becomes your worldview, and that makes the most sense to you. And you suddenly feel that everyone sharing that mode is an ally, and everyone outside of that mode is, you know, sort of a different being. And Walt Disney got at this in their clip called Motor Mania, their short film from the 1950s. And Goofy the dog begins life as Mr. Walker, sort of normal.
I saw that in traffic school many years ago. It's probably okay, many people did. Yeah.
And, you know, so he gets behind the car, becomes Mr. Wheeler, a homicidal maniac. But you see this in all sorts of bizarre ways. I mean, I cycle across the Brooklyn Bridge occasionally, and you have to go past pedestrians who are in the next lane. And there's disputes right there, and those forms of transportation aren't that different. I mean, it's just you're on top of a machine. I mean, you're not inside a 3,000-pound tinted window SUV. This is just a bike. But again, we become sort of different people, I think, based on the mode of transportation, and it gets easy to raise that enmity that you mentioned.
It's easy to get distracted too, as you point out, and with cell phones and alcohol and all the other things that seem to interfere with driving safety, we have to ask why the United States has fallen in traffic safety. Once was world leader, wasn't it?
It was, going back to the 1960s, and now it's dropped. It's sort of depending on how you measure it versus, you know, population versus miles driven. We're sort of 14th or 16th, and there's a whole host of reasons ranging from education to enforcement to engineering. All the famous three E's of traffic safety, really. And Europe, for example, is doing things like really heavily leaning on automated speed enforcement, which is sort of a political non-starter in many places in the United States. Europe also uses a lot of these roundabouts I mentioned. And there's different factors. The driving population tends to be a little bit different in Europe, but a whole host of complicated reasons. But distraction is a problem globally, and it's been a problem for sort of ever. I mean, as that great driving theorist Albert Einstein once observed, any man who says he can drive safely and kiss a pretty girl at the same time is clearly not giving the kiss the attention it deserves. So there's always been something else to do in the car, and driving itself becomes – we become so good at it, and it becomes a practice activity. Our mind tends to wander, and we have leftover sort of mental capacity, and unfortunately we tend to – now plow that into incredibly distracting technologies like texting, which, you know, there's a my book is available as a book on tape. I mean, there's a reason we advise people to listen to it on tape and not to try to read the book as they're actually driving, which is essentially what texting is.
Where's the worst traffic now in the United States? Is it still Los Angeles?
Los Angeles sort of switches with New York. New York has the single worst bottleneck situation, but, I mean, L.A. definitely comes out on top, and your Houstons, your Atlantas, your Phoenixes are all sort of up there. But New York is, of course, a perennial heavyweight.
And what do we know about gender in driving? Certainly there was a lot of what I suppose could be called a mild misogyny when I was growing up, women drivers and all that. What does the research show?
Well, there's a clear gender divide in terms of the most serious types of crashes, and especially fatal crashes. I mean, men lead in this category. And it's not just because men still do tend to drive more miles than women. I mean, when you adjust for that, men are still coming out on top. And if you look at all the risky behaviors that a person can do behind the wheel, not wearing a seatbelt, drinking, not wearing a helmet if you're on a motorcycle, it's the men on top every time. And whether this is testosterone or cultural conditioning, you know, is sort of beyond me. But there's a clear divide in that. One study did find that women were involved in more minor crashes, which I thought was interesting. And like everything, the study was complex, and I don't want to make a blanket statement here, especially since the one thing I do know about women is that they statistically buy more books. So I wouldn't want to make any claims against women.
Well, we'll make certain that that doesn't happen. I hope not only for the sake of your book sales, but just to be certain that we're mindful of being fair to the fair sex.
But if I could point out one other thing, I mean, there are interesting ways in which that whatever gender divides are out there are narrowing. And recently there's been, in certain states like California, the number of DWI cases involving women has been increasing. And this was even dubbed by one person as sort of a Sex in the City effect, that young women in particular were going out more, imbibing very potent cocktails in great number, and then getting on the road. So that certain gaps are narrowing.
We had that recent tragedy, that woman who apparently killed a couple of her nieces and children, I believe in New Jersey, in fact. And she had been drinking furtively, or certainly her blood alcohol level showed that she had been drinking, surreptitiously. What about, you know, I was in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania not too long ago, and I was with my niece, and she was saying people drive differently here. There's much more courtesy. In fact, she was saying sometimes it makes her crazy because they're always giving you the right of way and saying, please, you know, go ahead and so forth. I mean, different cities maybe have different driving cultures. Is that true?
I think that's true to some extent. If you go to a place like Seattle, I found Seattle to be an incredibly polite city and also very law-abiding. And I was myself was almost ticketed for jaywalking in Seattle, which, you know, is something I do as a New Yorker out of habit. And I almost wonder if there's sort of a east-to-west sort of lessening of driving hostility that happens, New York being, I think, the capital of honking. I mean, you won't hear traffic engineers joke that the shortest amount of recorded time is the moment between when a New York City traffic light turns green and the time the person honks behind you. I mean, that's sort of, you know, we don't even know how short that time is. But so, you know, and Pittsburgh has what they call the Pittsburgh left, which is, I don't know if that's courtesy or a form of aggression of its own, where people often take the left turn on a green before the traffic has started going the other way. Sometimes people might wave them into that, but so there definitely are sort of regional driving variations, although some places like Seattle, they gripe that more Californians are moving there and sort of spoiling the driving culture with their impatient
behavior. Yeah, I remember,
behavior.
I think it was a Woody Allen film where it talked about the one cultural advantage of being in California was being able to make a right turn on a red light. But you mentioned jaywalking in New York. Talk a little bit about the jaywalking differences between New York and Copenhagen. That's kind of fascinating.
Yeah, a visitor to Copenhagen, one of the things that's most striking is that, especially a visitor from New York, because the first thing you want to do is cross against the light, especially on a winter's morning when it's cold out and you want to get inside for that cup of coffee, and you find that you're the only one doing it, and people are looking at you with almost sort of a mild sense of almost like a pity you feel that like you couldn't wait for the light to change. And so that there's incredibly rigid sort of you know, obeyance to the traffic signals. And this is another interesting thing where traffic, you know, it's not just engineering, it's not just machines. There is a cultural underlay there as to how people are going to behave or not. And as far as I could tell, people aren't really given tickets for jaywalk. I mean, it may happen, but it's not necessarily an enforcement issue. It's just that people tend to want to do it. And I tried to look for some deeper cultural explanations that sort of revolved around, throughout Scandinavia, a sense of a very strong communitarian ethos, a sense that if you behave differently than the mass, you will sort of be seen as not a good citizen, and that might explain some of that. But in other cases, it is just strictly traffic engineering. If pedestrians aren't given ample crossing times, ample opportunities to cross, they will jaywalk more. This is sort of an iron law of traffic engineering.
Talking with Tom Vanderbilt. His book is Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do and What It Says About Us, a national bestseller now out in paper. And the worst traffic of all on Saturdays.
This is what researchers have been finding in certain markets. 1 p.m. on Saturday, it's just sort of a witching hour of – it's not obviously the work commute. Well, for many people, it is the work commute. And then it's people taking their kids to soccer, people shopping, all these – and those are the sorts of trips. It's interesting to look at the way driving behavior has changed in the U.S. over the past three decades. It's not to really look at the traffic problem. It's not simply that we've added more people. I mean, the population has increased, but what's really increased at a much greater rate than the population is the number of miles the average American drives every year. And a lot of this is to do things via car that we once did in other ways, such as take kids to school. I think about 15% of American children now walk to school. When I was young, not to date myself, I walked to school every day. That's now a sharply minority behavior.
Chris, and, a lot of that has to do with fear, too, and concern about predators that may be over-exaggerated, but nevertheless that many parents have.
Fear, yes, and then often people have – the way we now lay out a lot of our suburban environments, it's simply not safe, or the perception is there that it's not physically safe to walk, not because of stranger danger but because of cars. And you sort of look at some of the statistics, some of the reports, you find that the kids struck in front of schools are often struck by the parents of other kids driving their kids to school. So you create these sort of bad situations, and they just tend to snowball.
One also learns from your book that notwithstanding all those signs that are out there, they don't necessarily change behavior.
Yeah, there's an argument that we oversign in the U.S., and I think there's definitely something to that. And a lot of these things are put up because, quite frankly, traffic engineers want to avoid liability suits, and they need to sort of cover their behind and put up a sign for everything. But they've done interesting studies where they'll actually stop someone after they've been driving for a period and ask the person to note the last number of signs they've seen. And people really can't remember any. They tend to remember speed limit signs because it just sort of goes into a psychological dynamic on the road that we're looking for the signs that we want to see. And most signs don't interest us. We want to know the signs that will really sort of keep us out of trouble. And they've also done very quirky experiments at four-way stops where they've change the lettering on stop signs so that they read something else. And people, in most cases, don't notice the weird lettering at all. And what they're really doing is doing a quick glance. They see the red octagon. They know they're expecting it to be there. They move on. So there's an argument that simply adding to this visual clutter takes people's eyes away from the road, which is really where they should be. But you find as we pile on more laws, the laws require signs to be able to be enforced. I was just in Texas, for example, and they now have a law in which it's illegal to use a phone while you're driving in a school zone, one of those little flashing areas where you're supposed to go 20 miles an hour, although no one does. Now they need a new sign saying you're not allowed to use your cell phone in this flashing school zone. Whether someone on a cell phone is going to have the mental capacity to even see that sign is a question that deserves a little bit more investigation, I think.
Well, there are a lot of questions in Tom Vanderbilt's book. In fact, early on he says, puzzling questions swim to the surface when you think about traffic. Why can one sit in traffic jams that seem to have no source? Why does a 10-minute incident create 100 minutes of gridlock? Do people really take longer to vacate a parking space when someone else is waiting, or does it just seem so? And do the carpool lanes on highways help fight congestion or cause more of it? And just how dangerous are large trucks? And how does what we drive, where we drive, and with whom we drive affect the way we drive? Well, those are the kinds of questions that are answered in this book, but you may have some questions of your own, and you may want to comment just on, traffic and driving. That's what we're talking about this hour with Tom Vanderbilt. It's sort of like the weather beyond our control, and in many ways it's certainly something that affects all of us. As I said in my introduction, as you learn in his book, there are about 1,500 to 2,000 discrete skills that you use just while driving. So think about that and think about all these other things that we're kind of bringing to the surface here this hour, and think about what you'd like to say or ask, because the phone lines are open and available to you. It's toll-free from anywhere, whether you're listening again on radio, internet, or Sirius XM satellite. Feel free to join the program. Our number, 866-733-6786. Again, that's toll-free, 866-733-6786. Or send an email to forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with author and journalist Tom Vanderbilt, who is also known for his work in the blog Design Observer and is contributing editor to a couple of design magazines and has had his work appear in many publications. Malcolm Gladwell, the famed Malcolm Gladwell, says a very clever young writer about Tom Vanderbilt, even though Tom Vanderbilt said last segment that he was probably dating himself at one point, calls him a very clever young writer who tells us all sorts of things about what driving says about us. And Jonathan Yardley of the Washington Post says about the book, engagingly written, meticulously researched, endlessly interesting and informative. Again, it's called Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do and What It Says About Us. And we're hearing from you, our listeners, about traffic and driving. And let's go to Catherine. Good morning.
Hi. I had a question. I was wondering if you had looked at how much commercials, car commercials, and billboards affect the way that people drive, because they seem to be extolling the virtues of having this car because it drives so fast and can maneuver all these quick, tight little situations instead of, talking about safety. And this is a great car because it's reliable. I have noticed, the last several years I've lived in the Bay Area most of my life, and how much worse drivers have become. And it seems to me that there's a lot of tailgating, a lot of zipping, kind of like the commercials show. You just zip around this person without putting on your blinkers and, coming up. I think tailgating is a huge problem on freeways. And anyway,
a huge problem. And you raise, quite a provocative and interesting question, because I've seen many of these car commercials and wondered, what are they advertising here? They're advertising the speed of the car and, how fast you can move in it and do it presumably without any harm. What do you think, Tom Vanderbilt?
It's a very good question, and indeed reminds me of a Canadian study I saw that actually examined a number of car commercials and found that in a majority of the commercials they looked at, they depicted unsafe driving acts. And typically these were men at the wheel, and SUVs were sort of more implicated in the unsafe acts. And of course, there's always a disclaimer at the bottom, and they're always set in some stretch of highway in Utah, which none of us really ever drive. And it's sort of, car commercials never really get around to showing, I suppose, in the same way that beer commercials really never show a person with a hangover, car commercials never show a car sitting in traffic, or they never show any sort of the real world events that are out there, the real way that most of us drive and experience driving. And apart from a few exceptions, with things like airbags and companies like Volvo, they don't emphasize safety. When they do talk about safety, it tends to be devices within the car itself rather than the way the car should be driven. And just look down at your speedometer to find a great example of skewed marketing. My old Volvo that I got rid of had a top speed listed of 160 miles an hour. I know for a fact that the car was not really capable of much more than 100. And yet why is all this extra real estate on there? Well, it's to sort of seduce you, to entice you into thinking you have all that power at your disposal. And
how many horses do you have in there? Remember all that kind of talk? I mean, that's real testosterone talk. But as long as we're talking about speed here for the moment, I mean, when you're looking at miles per hour and you get in the whole controversy about should there be 55 limit, when you drive, say, on the Autobahn, or when you drive in places like Wyoming where they used to have no speed limits at all, I don't know if that's still the case, it's surprising how people don't necessarily abuse it. I wonder if there's a kind of reverse psychology there as well.
Well, the Autobahn example is brought up a lot, and I have driven on certain stretches of it. But the point about the Autobahn, there's a few things to say. One is we can't necessarily compare driving cultures. It's a little bit like apples and oranges. The German driving population tends to be wealthier, older. The Autobahn restricts trucks on Sundays. There's much better lane discipline. People don't pass as much. So some of the engineering is better. So there's certain factors that, and of course, the Autobahn is not necessarily the end-all be-all of safety. Germany is not the world's leading safest nation. I mean, they're not even in the top 10. So there's an argument, is the Autobahn the model we should be looking for? And in many cases, because of traffic congestion, those stretches of speed limit free driving on the Autobahn have actually been reduced in the last few years.
We'll go to more of your calls, and we go to Ken. Good morning, Ken.
Hey, good morning. Question. I've noticed since I've lived in San Francisco for the last 25 years, and maybe this applies to every city in the nation, drivers increasingly don't signal turns, and there's nothing that tells a pedestrian more important information than which way this car, this two-ton rolling machine in front of him or her, is going to go. And it also has the wonderful benefit of helping other drivers also, and it takes no effort on part of the driver, yet somehow, as the late Herb Cain wrote, Drivers seem to think signaling turns is giving information to the enemy. What can be done to reinvigorate these most basic driving rules that really take no effort on part of the driver but improve safety for everyone? I mean, it's amazing when you think about it. People can buy cars, and can you think of another machine that is so potentially dangerous yet requires so little training to use? Don't be a stinker. Use your blinker.
Okay. We've heard that before. And Tom Vanderbilt, want to comment?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good point and one that I suffer from every day as well. And I think one reason might be simple, this point of distraction. Again, someone might have their hand on a cell phone and doesn't have the extra hand or extra brain power free to do that third thing, signal. Another question I wondered whether it might be sort of a larger cultural thing where, for example, there's something called the Narcissistic Personality Index that psychologists have been asking people over the last few decades a number of questions. And the questions range – an example would be if I ruled the world, it would be a better place. And each year, more people answer yes to that question. So you sort of combine that with a sense of, again, this sort of personal multitasking that's going on. And we all sort of have the sense that we're out there in our own environment. The car seems like a private space even though it's in the midst of public space. And I think, you know, it's almost part of some decline of the common civic sphere where we just think it's not worth our time to let someone else know what we're doing. And the third point is that the police really, you know, enforcement has gone down. In many cities, New York included, the number of tickets issued has just simply gone down. Police are not paying attention. And there's a suspicion out there that traffic crime is not real crime. This is something I'm writing about right at the moment. But something like signaling, if you want to think of the old broken windows theory of criminology, these little events, the more we tend to ignore them, they arguably lead to larger infractions on the road, just contribute to a sense that no one is sort of paying attention to the law, no one's there to enforce it. And but again, the caller is right. It's really just a matter of courtesy as well.
And we'll hear from more of our callers. We'll go to San Jose. Ben, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. Yeah, I've driven in a lot of cities, in like Los Angeles. I've driven in New York and D.C. and Atlanta and Houston and of course, San Francisco. But I wanted, and you were speaking before about different cultures of driving, and there are a couple of traffic law kind of things and courtesy things you mentioned, but I was interested in the statistics of like which cities are absolutely the most dangerous to drive in and like sort of the worst cities to drive in. And I have a strong suspicion it's Boston.
Do we know Tom Vanderbilt much on that score? Hello? We lost Tom. Well, we'll reconnect with him. We lost the connection somehow. Actually, apropos of that, I've got a listener who sent the following email. He said, you should be aware of the tremendous differences between California and Washington State. I drive off in near Seattle, and they enforce their speed and safe driving laws there. You seldom go far without seeing patrol ticketing drivers at roadside. As a result of enforcement, traffic is going within limits. There's no tailgating, no switching back and forth between lanes. When I return, I'm always shocked. On my trip into town, about 8 miles, I'm driving a raceway. Cars are often passing me, going 90 with tailgating and rapid switching of lanes back and forth. It's madness. Of course, I've had the same experience various places in California. For some reason, politicians here are unwilling to take on the minority who endanger driving for all of us. All we need for much safer driving on our freeways would be enforcement. I'd never bet we're going to ever get it. Tom, do we have you back here, Tom Vanderbilt?
We do.
Yeah, we lost you there for a minute. Don't know whose fault it was, but glad to have you again. Tell me, though, the listener want to know, do we have any statistics about what cities or areas are the most unsafe to drive in?
Well, in some ways, we don't. I mean, we have things that insurance companies have done, like Allstate, for example, and they find that places like Sioux Falls, South Dakota, are people go the longest time between filing insurance claims. But that's sort of a little bit misleading because there's fewer people to sort of run into in Sioux Falls than in New York City, for example. But that raises an interesting point, which is that city driving in general is actually among the safest driving you can do from the point of view of the most serious crashes, fatal crashes. And this was something that was eye-opening to me. But the state of Montana, for example, leads the nation in the number of fatalities per mile driven. So statistically, Montana is the most dangerous place you can be
big
driving.
Big sky country. People go a little bit out of their lose control.
Exactly. And what's what's safest? It turns out to be the state of Massachusetts, and you know, people have this image of Boston drivers as maniacal, and indeed they may be maniacal, but you know, in a city environment, because speeds are tend to be kept to a lower number, there's only so much trouble you can get into. And there was even a study done by a guy in Virginia who looked at he compared the risk, basically the mortality risk of leaving your home in the suburbs of Virginia versus inner city Baltimore, I believe it was, and basically found that the suburbs were actually, when you added in auto fatalities, were more dangerous than certain inner city parts of Baltimore in terms of risk from strangers.
Well, speaking about that kind of risk and the statistics, one often hears that driving is considerably less safe than being in an airplane, and that's that holds up, doesn't it?
It does. People have done little slices and dices of the data, but yeah, it definitely holds up. The trip to the airport is indeed more dangerous than flying in the plane itself.
As they say, and we go to Allentown, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Jared. Good morning.
Good afternoon from the East Coast. How are you?
Hi.
Good. Hey, I just wanted to comment to a topic that rings true to my heart. I'm a salesman, and I drive 42,000 miles a year. So my thoughts are narcissistic, and I feel that I'm a better driver. Is there something that backs that up? Also, I'm wondering, on Fridays and Mondays especially, you see a lot of people who are driving to and from vacations who just aren't mindful of the rules of the road, as people who use driving as a career would be. Is that something that's true or just a perception?
Hmm. Do we know Tom Vanderbilt? Yeah.
I think that's a valid point. And I've seen studies that talk about, you know, basically the morning commute is the safest type of driving as a class. You have everyone wanting to basically get to work. They're all sort of sober, more or less awake. And it's a very sort of concentrated driving population. You don't have a lot of teens and their friends. You don't have people drinking, for example. The afternoon commute becomes a little bit less safe because that fatigue issue might be entering in. There might be some drinking behavior there. And then this weekend sort of discretionary driving, that tends to get a different sort of culture out on the road, sort of measurably different. And that's one thing that the number of fatalities have dropped recently, in large part because of the economy. People are driving less, but it's also there's been some studies looking at suggesting the type of driving people are doing has dropped, which is that discretionary driving, that people have less money to go on vacation, to go to these weekend trips. So, but again, it does raise a valid point, and indeed there are weekends are sort of more dangerous for a reason.
Steve is our next caller, joining us from Rockport, Missouri. Welcome, Steve.
Good morning. Just a couple of quick comments here. I've been involved in the trucking industry on two sides of the Atlantic. I was born and raised in the UK. I've got over 3 million miles of experience in this country trucking. I'm trucking at the moment. I think that Americans are good drivers, but they could be a hell of a lot better with a lot more education. I've encountered all of the problems that you've talked about here, usually on a daily basis. But if people were educated better, perhaps we could have a national standard for driver testing and driver education. I think we could make things a lot safer for everybody.
Steve, are you holding the phone in your hand while you're driving your truck?
No, I'm talking on a hands-free device.
Okay, had to check that. Sorry. But what about education, Tom Vanderbilt? National education and making drivers more aware through national education?
I mean, certainly I would be well in favor of more education in the U.S. I think, you know, from the people I've talked to, I've talked to driving instructors who teach foreigners who come to the U.S. to get their licenses, and they all tend to regard U.S. driving education as something of a joke, and the standard required to actually get a license being equally risible. And it's a bit of an X factor, though. I mean, no one has been able to find sort of a link between one country's style of driving education or the rigor of the driving education and their subsequent road safety record. Germany, for example, has incredibly expensive and lengthy driving education process. Does that make them safer than the UK? No. But again, I do think a lot of the best improvements in driver education are right now coming from Europe, and we're a little bit struggling to catch up, which is, again, why we've dropped from number one.
And I thank Steve for his call. I want to go to some of your emails. Francis writes, in Sweden, the two merging lanes are painted in a way that resembles a zipper, and this notifies the drivers to take turns merging, alternating between the driver in the right lane and the driver in the left lane. It works very well. I haven't driven there recently, but assume they still use that system. And A writer named Michael writes, hello, I'm curious if your author could comment on whether his research determines why so many Americans seem to be ignorant about general rules of the road that slower drivers should drive in the slow lane versus plodding along in the fast lane and thus forcing drivers to pass on the right side versus on the left side, which I believe is the law. Think of those signs on four-lane highways that say, keep left except to pass. I've driven in many other countries, and there my experience is that drivers in these countries almost universally stay in slow lanes except to pass. Not so in the U.S., where it seems many people are completely oblivious to the stack of cars lining up behind them, then forced to pass on the right, which creates traffic and a potentially dangerous situation. Why are U.S. drivers so clueless to so many of these basic rules of the road?
Well, that's a very common complaint, and I always find it a bit ironic that people grumble about drivers not obeying the posted law on a sign to move over if you're slower traffic when there's another posted law on a sign, which is stating what the speed is supposed to be on that road. And so it just raises an interesting question. And then there's always someone who's going to want to go faster. So I think this pressure, there's always this tension. I mean, is the left lane only for passing, or is it a quote-unquote fast lane? But the U.S., I think we're such a rights-based, rights-centered nation that often the people in the left lane going the legal speed limit feel that they have the right to be there as much as the person behind them feels they have the right to force them to get over. But the caller's right. In places like Italy, there's a much more aggressive response if you're sort of hanging out in that left lane at a speed lesser than you should be.
You know, they call it driving in Italy. They call it a blood sport. I mean, I can speak from experience here driving to Cortona from Florence. Well, here's Max who writes, thank you for a great program. Please ask your guests to discuss driving and age. As I age, I am now 69. I trust my driving less and less. I seem to be more easily distracted, or to put it differently, my ability to concentrate on the task at hand seems to be impaired. Yet I am in very good physical condition. I'm playing the best tennis I ever played. I'm very quick on my feet. My reflexes are excellent. And driving at night is a real burden. I'd appreciate your guest comments. Well, there's no age marker. In fact, I was hearing a story over the weekend about a late uncle of mine who was stone deaf and nevertheless was given a good deal of courtesy with respect to his driving test so that he was able to pass it. He was in his late 80s at the time. This is a case in which maybe somebody shouldn't have been given too much courtesy. He shouldn't have been on the road, probably. And determining that is very, very difficult.
Yeah, it's a real problem. And if you look at the risk of drivers on the road, it's a U-shaped curve. It's quite interesting. The highest points are in the teenage years, and then as a driver gets older. And teens, the problem, they have great reflexes, they have great skills, but it's really their attitude and their decision making. Older drivers, their skills, the reflexes and vision tend to go down, but they obviously have a lot of experience, and they're very cautious in the way they drive, and they only drive in certain environments. They self-select themselves out of driving in certain points. But yeah, we shouldn't castigate an entire class of older drivers, but there is already being, you know, new work done at DMVs to sort of filter out and look for these problems. Things like, can you detect – not just can you read the eye chart, but can you detect the difference in contrast between the letters and the background, which is a problem at night driving, for example. And there's a new program. I think it's called Drive Sharp to help – it supposedly helps sharpen cognitive abilities of older drivers by forcing you to look at sort of your peripheral vision. Whether that can really work, I'm not sure. But there is work going on.
Well, there's a lot of work to be done. The deterioration can happen so fast. And if the driving record is okay, you know, they can go years before they really need to reestablish themselves as licensed drivers. I think, in fact, in many cases, it's just an unwillingness of people to admit that they're starting to falter and things are atrophying, and that unwillingness is a hazard to themselves as well as to others. Yeah.
And driving, you know, obviously the way we live in the U.S. to not drive is for many people, you know, something like a prison sentence.
That's right.
And you know, takes you out of a social network, it takes you out of all sorts of opportunities, and some ways can be equally bad for you as going out on the road and being a risk. So,
here for more of our callers, Martin from Santa Clara. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I've driven all over the world, India and Asia and Europe, many different parts of it. And it seems like each country has its own sort of status, set speed. Like in Europe, even on the Autobahn, you talked about that. But it seems like most people travel at around 140, 150 kilometers an hour. You're always going to have the people that go faster. But that seems steady state for most of the population. It seems like in India, They run at about 60, 65 kilometers an hour. Of course, they drive completely differently than anyone I've ever seen. But, you know, and then in Asia, it seems to be around 50 kilometers an hour. So given that everyone has this comfort zone and people wake up in the morning, they get in their cars, and they don't plan on getting killed. But there is a percentage of the population that definitely causes most of the accidents. Not young or old, but it's attitude-based, I believe. Now, is there a percentage of population that is, you know, that we know about that says 30% of these drivers are going to be this narcissistic type, you know, I get to do what I want to do? So, you know, I just don't know if statistics are available regarding that type of population.
Tom Vanderbilt?
I haven't seen that correlation made. I mean, but the caller does raise a good point. I mean, a lot of people making the violations and driving the risky behavior are the ones causing the problem. And have been interesting studies done, for example, that link people look at driving records of a group of people and compare people who have criminal records off the road and then how many violations do they have on the road. And there's definitely a relationship there where the people who have more criminal records off-road tend to commit more violations. So it's sort of the idea is that just a lessened regard for the law in all areas of life, and that translates into driving. There's an old cliche in driving research, which is a man drives as he lives, and in some case that holds true today.
I thank Martin for his call. I want to go to some emails here. Adriano says, why is honking considered so rude and taboo in the U.S., whereas it's almost a means of communication in cities like Rome or Istanbul?
Yeah, that's a good question. In Delhi, I noticed an interesting behavior with the auto rickshaw drivers, which is that the drivers wouldn't signal. They would simply start to make the lane change. And if the driver behind them honked, that was their signal that it was not okay to do it. And they sort of shifted the burden of responsibility onto the other driver. And so the result was in Delhi, you never basically stop hearing a horn. And if you did, you would realize something catastrophic had gone wrong, because it is day to night. It is just a constant sound. And again, it's one of these, I suppose, cultural acclimation things. It just becomes the norm, the social norm of behavior. If you go to Switzerland and act like you did in Delhi, you would really stand out. And I think after a few days in Switzerland, you probably wouldn't do that and you would instantly acclimate. So traffic is, it's like, really, it's just a form of culture. Going to another country, you learn how to deal with the money, the language, and you start to act like the locals. And I think driving often acts that way as well.
Here's Joe, who writes, an overlook factor in the rise in distracted driving is the ease with which a modern car can be driven in the name of safety, perhaps at the behest of saviors like Ralph Nader. Automobiles have been engineered for a degree of safety and easy operation that gives false confidence to even the most idiotically smug driver. Automobiles have become cocoons of comfort and insulation that can give an impression that there is nothing else on the road. Let's go to more of your calls here, and we'll get Marcel on next. Thank you for waiting. You're on.
Well, thanks for taking my call. They say the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. Yeah, it's just sort of a joke that, you know, driving cars has killed more people than people have been killed in all the wars. It's total insanity, and they just keep doing it. I mean, I read this. I sold my car a couple of years ago. I have two bikes, one electric assisted. I read this book called Divorce Your Car by Kathy Alvarez, and it really woke me up. And I feel like I'm, you know, totally liberated, and of course a lot of people can't do that, but if they promoted more public transportation and bike lanes and promoting alternative transportation, then you know, we'd be dealing with the real problem. But no, they don't deal with the real problem. They just talk about, you know, better cars, bigger highways, and they just continue adding fuel to the fire. Every, you know, almost every program you have on your station, all the other stations, you know, it's all about how to make driving better, how to improve the roads, you know, this cash for clunkers. I mean, it's a joke to me. It's just insanity. So let's get a response.
Well, I think implicit in those remarks is the necessity to beef up and have better public transportation and systems, infrastructures that enhance public transportation. But what do you say, Tom Vanderbilt?
Well, and not just that, but I do think, you know, incentives essentially not to drive. I mean, the U.S., to look at the Netherlands, for example, people think, you know, there's an incredibly high cycling rate in the Netherlands, and people think, well, the Dutch just like to cycle. But the Dutch actually have a pretty high car ownership rate. They're not anti-car necessarily, but they use the car when it's appropriate to make that journey. It's one of many tools that they have to get around. And in the U.S., we've sort of fallen into this trap of, you know, having to use the quart of gas to go get the quart of milk. I mean, the car, there's no trip that we can make without the car. And so
we are a preeminent car culture, I think. And California, probably among all the United States states, is the preeminent state as far as car cultures. But it's still hard to get your mind around the fact that we have more cars than citizens.
Well, cash for clunkers may have changed that relationship.
Well, we'll have to wait until the final numbers are in. Let's get a quick call in from Sacramento. Nick, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking the call. Actually, I'm going to partially echo your last comment in that my perspective is I think if you compare European, particularly my home country, the UK, with the US, it's interesting to see how the culture has grown and the style of driving has been propagated and reflected in the actual position of cars and transport in lifestyle, i.e., like you say, here there is a mentality that really you get in the car to go do anything and you need to. And secondly, you know, there's been a big emphasis on the car being comfortable, smooth, powerful, quick off the lights, etc., but doing everything for you. In reflection, the UK, you know, a lot of cars create more of an experience of being connected to the road. Many of the smaller roads require you to concentrate and take curves and bends.
Yeah, but you drive on the wrong side of the road.
Actually, so did you originally before you changed, but that's a bit of history. the position of driving in the mind of the average English person, I think, is that it's a skill that they master and enjoy and they're actively engaged with. And this is not a bashing of the U.S. as a comparison, but I think, you know, cars beget the driver, beget the cars. And here it's, you know, it's a comfortable cruising. It's powerful off the line when you want to go off the lights. But really, you know, nobody goes out on a Sunday afternoon just to drive the tight curves and everything just to feel the curves.
Well, what a note to end on, Nick. Cars beget the drivers. The drivers beget the cars. Thank you for that call. And we have come to the end of the hour. Tom Vanderbilt, it's been a pleasure to have you.
Great to be here.
The book, again, is Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do and What It Says About Us. And it will be in paperback soon, I think, coming out shortly. I'd said it was out in paperback, but it's imminent. Thank you for being with us this hour. We appreciate your listenership. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and also our producers. Erica Kelly is with us today. Also, thank our engineer, Dave Freeman, and our executive editor, Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.